Welcome to Words and Things with your host, Kurt Maxey, and co-host, Vinoy Bernot. Now, let's explore and discover the wonders of words and things.
Hey, good evening. Hope you guys have found a cool spot. And let's start to show off with what's coming up.
We got Circumstances by Devon C. Scott.
We sure do. And we have The Daughters of the Kush by George Corbin, a writer friend of mine. And the theme of these two pieces focus around black college life. Mm-hmm. And we also have Straight Outta Compton doing really, really well in
Very
the theaters
well.
This weekend.
Over 50 million just the first 2 days.
And let me just pass the baton on and let Vinoy tell you a little bit about Circumstances.
So a little bit about Circumstances is it's written by Devon C. Scott, a very talented writer who I had the pleasure of meeting while I was in college in Dallas at SMU. And he happens to be a member of Kappa Alpha Psi, so he is a pretty boy, as I am a pretty girl, a member of AKA sorority, all right? So it's very special, and his words have always captured me. Just anytime I read Devon's work. So I'm very excited during the casting process and when I first brought this up to Kurt. Thanks for letting us do it. And I'm excited about Antoine Barnes, who we got to read this, a very talented young man who just graduated from college. And I'll let him introduce himself and tell us a little bit about himself before he begins.
Hello, 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 everyone. My name is Antoine Barnes. Just recently graduated from Cal State Fullerton with a BFA in musical theater. I'm here in the summer of L.A. It's beautiful. It's pretty hot, but it's wonderful and it's enjoyable. I'm having fun. I'm pursuing acting to the fullest of my capabilities. Yeah.
All right. And now for the reading of Circumstances by Devon C. Scott of Dallas, Texas.
It was a warm and sunny morning in the summer of 1998 when I drove home from my frat brother's apartment. We all went out to a frat party the night before, and I got so trashed that I couldn't even put one foot in front of the other. All I remember from that night was stopping off at the 24-hour grocery store to get some Captain Crunch Berry cereal because I had the munchies. When we got to Paul's place, everyone hit the floor and crashed out. We were packed like refugees, all asleep on his living room floor. Next morning, we woke up laughing and tripping out about all the crazy happenings that went down the night before. A bunch of us just decided to kick it at the lake later, so I had to go home and shower and change for the day. As I drove home, I was listening to this song by reggae artist Buju Banton. The chorus of the song was, "Circumstances made me what I am." The words hit me like a time vortex. I found myself traveling through the circumstances of my life from past, present, to the future. Suddenly, I was riddled with a wide array of emotions. One minute I was smiling, then I was teary-eyed and frowning. I thought about all the circumstances and experiences that brought me to the moment in time. I always said I was born one part out of love and one part out of a feeling too good to stop. However, my mom raised me with love despite the pain of my father's absence. I reflected on that for a moment and thought, that's damn for sure a circumstance that made me what I am because I swore that I would be the man my father wasn't. First, by being a husband and a father. However, before I can do all that, I'd have to begin my passage into manhood. Becoming a man in today's society is not easy. Many men in my generation were born in that period of fatherless children. And for some reason, the depiction of the American pimp in the movie Superfly was like some mind-controlling device. It caused many black men to turn their business suits for zoot suits. I think this was the second greatest tactic America used to destroy the black family structure. Well, not counting putting crack in the ghetto and the Tuskegee experiment. But many young boys grew up in a household where their moms acted as both mother and father. They went out to hunt and brought home to kill because they were survivors. These fatherless households bore a new era of boys that became men, angry men, determined men, family men, but it also reared an era of hurt men, sexually confused men, and mentally abused men. And for many of them, this was the start of their heaven or hell in their lives. For a long time, I lived in a prison without walls, the prison of my circumstances, of being raised without a father that made it hard to realize my place and purpose as a man. It was not easy trying to define myself as a man by learning from the mistakes of those that came before me. I mean, when your papa is a Rolling Stone and you grew up watching your mother suffer through it alone, it can make or break you as a man. One day you're either going to be a chip off the old block just like your papa, or you're going to be make a change because you never want to cause a woman suffering like your moms used to. I know many may think that becoming a man is a matter of age and financial status, meaning you have the bread to pay the bills and take care of a woman. However, any boy can be a pimp, but it takes heat, pressure, and time for a boy to become a man and take his stand in life for God and his family. As I continue listening to the song, I find myself traveling further through the time vortex of my mind. I thought about the circumstances of my life growing up as a child. My mom was a warrior queen. I've always said I thank God for blessing me with an angel for a mom. I say that because I've always been amazed at how she loves in spite of not being loved. She was a perfect wife and daughter-in-law, but she never got a ring. And yet, she would always be there for them in times of trouble or sickness. Watching her as a child really was a circumstance that made me what I am. The sacrifices she made working as a nurse by day and a cab driver by night. The times she did things she didn't want to just so we can have food to eat and a roof over our heads. Growing up, seeing my mom scrape and struggle really made me realize the importance of family. For a long time, I resented my father for running out on us. For 23 years, I wanted to kick his ass for all the pain and suffering I watched a woman in my life endure. I remember when my sister and I were little. She was 12 and I was 10. My mom dated this guy named Jake. He seemed like a cool fella at the time, but that all came crashing down the day he tried to touch my sister. I recall sitting at the top of the stairs, listening to my sister as she cried to my mom when she got home from work. Mom worked mornings and Jake worked nights, so he kept us through the day and left an hour before my mom got home every day. Words cannot explain the pain I felt sitting there hearing the cries of my mom and big sisters. My sister described the things he did and said to her. It filled me with so much pain, helplessness, resentment, and anger all at once. While I was thankful to God that he did not get to finish what he tried to start, I also felt the pain and helplessness because I was just a little boy and I couldn't have done anything to stop him even if I had actually tried, if he actually tried to rape my sister. Suddenly, I started feeling pissed and angry at Jake for being the kind of man that would touch a child when we trusted him and saw him almost like a father. Then I got plumb hateful with resentment for my real father because I thought if his ass was there being a daddy, this would have never happened to us. From that moment on, I swore I would protect my family no matter what. And as funny as it may seem, for a little boy to be huffing and puffing, talking about fighting grown men, I knew that he or any other man would never get the chance again. From that circumstance on, I was never the same. As I got older, I started lifting weights, learning how to fight and defend myself. I was determined one day to find Jake and my father and kick both their asses for the pain they caused my mom and sister. Seeing my mom go through the things she went through pained me because I knew if my father was there, she wouldn't have to. It is because of her love, dedication, and faith in God that I realized my role as a man. I always used to say that if love was money, I would have been the richest kid in America, just like Richie Rich, because that's what my mom surrounded and spoiled us with. The circumstances of the pain that hurt me and and the love that healed me throughout my adolescent years truly made me what I am. It is because of this, I have come to understand a man's role and the reason why we men have to keep God in our hearts and stand up and be the heads of our households. It is a man's responsibility and duty to do, to be the provider and protector of our families. Some brothers have lost sight of this somewhere over the years, allowing life to make them scared and intimidated by life standards rather than living their lives by the standards of God. Many men have let life beat them into a skirt, thinking that playing a woman frees him of his purpose and duties under God and his family. Other men have lived a gigolo lifestyle of cars, clothes, and hoes. In the end, he finds himself lying next to someone in bed, still feeling alone. Even now, I think back to that day riding home in the car, listening to the chorus of that song. Circumstances made me what I am. I think of the circumstances of my life through my years in high school and colleges, as well as the circumstances of love that made me what I am and will become. And through it all, I realized it was my ability to love in spite of not being loved that got me through. But it is not so much the circumstances, but how I chose to learn from them. I think about the heartaches and growing pains of my life and love that made me the man I am, and better still, the man I will become. And all those things, it is how I chose to learn and live the rest of my life from that moment on. I thank my mom for rearing me in a home where God was first in our lives, because my faith in God has been the source of my strength that has always allowed me to weather circumstantial storms in my life. After my grandfather passed away in January 1999, I was riddled with the realization that I am the last of my name. The circumstance of that made me take my destiny more seriously. From the woman that is to share my life, to finding my purpose in life and which to provide for my family, that all must be ordained by God's grace. In that, the road has not yet been easy, but necessary. It has forged me for battle and gave me the things I need to survive later on down the line. See, when you remember the things you've been through, it fortifies you with the confidence to face your current battles. Honestly, I've been the victim and the villain in my lifetime. So I choose to not cast stone in a glass house, as my friend Paul would say. We all have had many hills and valleys in our individual roads of life. And I'm sure many of you feel that in your hearts. You feel that your hearts have paid the cost over and over again. So my question to you is, now what? How many times will we say amen and continue doing it again? The truth of it is that if we look back on the circumstances in our lives, we will find that we are so much more. For that matter, no one will ever truly understand the next person because we have not walked in his or her shoes, nor seen what they've seen. So how do we trust in one another? And why should we, when many of us can't even trust ourselves? The answer lies in the acceptance of our reality.
Woo! What a powerful piece. Oh my goodness. I'm sitting here, I'm meditating on it. It's marinating. How did that, portraying this character, this young college frat boy, reflecting on his life, like, how did that make you feel? And what drew you into wanting to portray this piece, you know, to audition and then accept the part?
Wow. Because in many cases, actually, I felt like it was me. It was me going through, you know, not specifically from circumstance to circumstance, but on a level where you can relate to a person, like, wow, I can see myself as that kid, you know, being raised in an environment where these circumstances, like, maybe not having a father or maybe not having the figure in your life that, you know, you probably needed or you thought you needed, you know. I took that and I was like, wow, it was powerful for me. And I really connected to it. And I knew I just really wanted to, you know, portray that, really read for it. It was such a strong, when I first read for it, I was like, wow, this is serious. This is real. Like, this is a real, you know, a real heartfelt, and it's personal too. So it was almost sacred, you know? So it's one thing you have to be really, it's one of those things you really have to be cognizant about when you're reading it.
Mm-hmm. And you got words. A chance to talk to the writer, playwright too. How was that?
Oh, it was inspiring. It was even more inspiring than just reading this, because imagine he writing this in a short story. Imagine the stories that's going on in his mind, you know? And he has that. He's an amazing, you know, me speaking to him alone and him just feeding me knowledge. At first, we were just talking about, you know, the short story and the context of it and what he meant, you know, where he was in his life when he wrote that.
This is a beautiful story. In the sanctity of this, though, do you find something within the story? We're in this continual circle, but is there something in there that's also made you feel like, hey, I got to pull myself out of this treadmill?
As far as like something that like kind of like I looked at and I was like, wow, I need to I think in so many cases, because he had mentioned how we sometimes become, because like a lot of us, especially in a city like Los Angeles, you know, and that's where I was raised. A lot of us, you know, it's a big stereotype. Like a lot of us don't have, you know, our fatherless children and such and such. And I think that hit me, because how he overcame that made me think like, wow, you know, even for myself, if I can hold on to, you know, the fact that you love in spite of not being loved, if I can do that little thing, like what he said, love in spite of not being loved, yeah, I can hold on to that, that'll allow me to, you know, transcend and go past like those circumstances that might have, you know, corrupted me or made me abused men, like mentally, you know, in my head, or I could have been anywhere else in my life, but trying to love in spite of not being loved, if I hold on to that, like while I continue on in my life, and you know, if I think that can encourage a lot of my, you know, friends, family, everybody in Los Angeles, everybody like around the world, like who go through similar problems like that, if you can hold on to love in spite of not being loved, it allows you to, you know, have that forgiveness. And that's powerful.
Right on.
Wow,
we're gonna have to have you come back in and read some more.
We
gotta get into Kush.
Oh yeah,
so daughters of the Kush.
We gotta set up here and get the daughters in here. But thank you, Antoine.
Oh yeah, all right, most welcome. Thank you.
Wonderful.
And you'll be reading the stage directions for the ladies of Daughters of Kush.
I
as
will
well.
Be.
All right.
We're making money off beer. stumbling across the path, but now I learn, I grow. I know much more now, no more searching, hurting, trying to find my way. I let spirit lead me through the day, in love with everything I see. Yeah, I'm getting paid to be me. Yeah, create a way where I am free. Yeah, ain't nothing wrong with being me.
Entertainer Dorian, and let's just get on straight with the Daughters of the Kush. So we'll introduce ourselves. On my left.
Hi, I'm Paris Rumford, and I'm playing the Pledge.
Hi, I'm Pauline Schanzer, and I'm playing Kathy.
Antoine Barnes, narration.
Yatide Badaki, Clara.
Harisi St. Cyr, Brenda.
Patricia Grant, Rhonda.
Daughters of the Kush. Synopsis. When Kathy Greenberg Battle, a white Jewish student at a small Midwestern university who had been raised in a black culture, decides to pledge the sole African-American sorority in 1963, it triggers unexpected consequences. If she is accepted to become one of the Daughters of the Kush, she would be the first white member. The daughter is responsible for admitting new sisters into the Kappa Lambda Nu, find that the ubiquitous college ritual of rush triggers unexpected tragedy and moral dilemmas when one succumbs to the volatile mixture of implicit bias, jealousy, and the self-assigned power as the defender of the daughters. From the waters of the mighty Nile came the daughters of the Kush. From the rolling sea of sand, from Africa, our motherland, strong women out history kept on why our ancestors wept, sister unto death, pledged to truth, knowledge, and our God, responding to our call to love all. Black mothers and daughters dear, lift them up, lift them up. Oh, sisters of Kappa Lambda Nu. Place, time, Plains University, a small institution in Iowa. It is 1963, a time of major societal change in America. which impacts the insular world of black college students. Scene 8. Setting. Clara's dorm room. Various track and field pictures and posters hang on the wall. A couple of trophies sit on her desk and ribbons are attached to her mirror. At rise, Clara is dressed as usual in her sweatsuit. There is a knock at the door.
Come in.
The door opens and Pledge enters, dressed in the colors of the sorority. She rings her candy bell once.
I came as you requested, big sister.
Sit, Candy.
Pledge fidgets.
But big sister, I have a test.
Don't worry about missing class. This won't take very long. I have an important task for you, Candy, and it's very confidential. You are to report only to me, no one else, you understand?
Yes, big sister.
Clara walks behind the Pledge and puts her hand on the back of the chair. The Pledge can only see her in the mirror.
If I remember correctly, you said your sister is a daughter at state, right? She would be beyond proud if you also became a daughter.
Yes, big sister. When I'm crowned, I plan to drive up to state you and surprise her. She's a senior like you.
Clara turns Pledge's chair around to face her. Then she sits on a chair facing her.
You speak as if your being crowned is a sure thing.
No, 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 big sister. I did not mean to give you that impression. In fact, my sister told me last year that two of the cushies on her line were not crowned.
I'm glad you finally understand that there's never any guarantee that a candy has made it.
What do you want from me, big sister?
What I want you to do is to keep an eye on Candy Battle and report back to me on anything she's done or doing that would not be approved for a candy.
Like what, big sister?
Any, and I mean any, violation of the daughter's code. If Greenberg does anything suspicious, you are to tell me at once, and as I said earlier, no one else.
I don't think I could do that. Spy on a sister or anyone. It's
what my... are some of the possible reasons you think those two candies were rejected?
I don't know. Perhaps grades, cheating, something that dishonors the sorority.
Yes, yes. And what types of behavior might dishonor, as you say?
Maybe sleeping around?
You mean having sex with lots of guys or even girls, right?
What are you getting at?
Well, let's say not only is sleeping around frowned upon, but, for instance, Melba Roth is rumored to have a girlfriend. Not that she's really public about it. She's a good friend of yours, I hear.
You don't think.
But I do think. And I do know of your secret meetings off campus. Lakeview Inn, I believe. Look, I don't like to bring this up. I know it's something you would rather keep secret. A couple of my track team members are hiding too, but unfortunately, I need your help, and this is the only way I can get it.
You don't have any real proof that I would even...
We all hide things we don't want others to see. The tricky part is to hide them in a place where they are not likely to be discovered. Not under your mattress.
You went through my things?
Of course I did. Candy's rooms can be inspected at any time by the Dean of Pledges.
Well, how did you get in? My roommate is not a pledge.
I just waited to catch her when she was leaving and asked if I could wait for you. We had a meeting.
I
see. You're the English major. Unconscionable? I'll make it easy for you. Each candy will be paired with a partner, a team of two, for the remainder of your pledge period. You will be expected to study together, eat together, etc. You will be Candy Battle's partner.
I understand. Can I go now?
Again, I'm sorry I have to do this to you. But if you get me what I need, this will be the last time I would bring it up. And you could count on my support.
The Pledge quickly exits. Clara closes the door and walks to the mirror and examines her face, then hangs her head. Stage darkens. End of scene 8. Scene 9. Setting. Common room set up for Pledge final interviews. The last step in selection process. At Rise, Brenda is sitting at a table with Clara and Rhonda on either side. They are wearing their daughter's gold band crowns. Brenda is wearing the Candace crown. Kathy enters and addresses her big sisters. She is wearing a gold candy sash. Kathy rings her bell once.
May a daughter of Kush enter into the presence of daughters Brenda, Clara, and Rhonda?
You may enter, Candy Battle, into the presence of the daughters of Kush.
Kathy stands and walks closer to the table.
I await your inquiry, daughters of Kush.
Why have you come, Candy?
I seek entry into the queendom of Kush to join those who are dedicated to the ideals of Kappa Lambda Nu.
And who has been your guide on your quest?
My guide has been Big Sister Rhonda, who with the torch of Candace has illuminated the path to Kappa Lambda Nu.
Are you prepared to prove yourself worthy?
Yes, Big Sister.
You can relax a bit now. Each of us will ask three questions. You are to answer honestly and completely. Understand?
Yes, Big Sister.
Okay, I'll start. If you are accepted, which of your personal qualities will help most in making our sorority even stronger?
Commitment. I'm an extremely dedicated person. Once I agree to do something, I give it my all. You can be assured that I would always walk the talk of the Daughters of Kush. Do you want to hear more, Big Sister?
No, that's fine.
Back your answer up with an example of your commitment.
Well, I could have gone home for the break, but I decided to stay and help little sisters Karen and Judy raise money for the chapter. I managed to sell 20 of our American History sister dolls, mostly to other sororities, $200 in all.
You did a great job.
You set a high standard for your fellow candies.
You seem to be trying to give the impression you somehow sacrificed something by remaining on campus.
My parents were very disappointed I wasn't able to celebrate my dad's 50th birthday with the rest of the family. They had planned a big party.
You should have gone home. I would have.
He's not your real dad, right?
Pops is my real dad, since I was 13.
That's an inappropriate question, Clara.
Sorry, Candy. That was a little out of line.
By the way, have all the little sisters gotten dates for the formal?
Everyone but Candy Brown. But she said one of her cousins is planning to drive up and will probably be her escort.
Who's bringing you?
Barry Wills, Big Sister. You know him, one of the track coaches.
Barry? He never said. How did you two...
About 2 months ago, I signed up for a ride home to Kansas City and Barry was the driver. The other rider didn't show up, so it was just the two of us. We talked quite a bit and found out that we had a lot in common. We just hit it off. After I got back, he called and asked me out. By the way, Big Sister Clara, Barry said you were a delight to coach. You always gave 100%.
Well, you know, I'm, of course, bringing my boyfriend.
Which of our Candakes do you most relate to and why?
Founder Candake Nelson. She persevered in her goal of learning to fly in 1927. She used her education and powers of persuasion to overcome many daunting obstacles. At that time, any woman, much less a Negro woman, had to constantly prove herself, fight the sexism, and in the case of Candace Nelson, it included racism. She was a first in many aspects of her life.
Do you see yourself as a first?
Being a first?
You know, a first Caucasian member?
Oh, no, not at all. Of course, I'm aware that if I'm accepted, I would be the first white sister in the chapter. I don't know if there have been any other white daughters in the history of Kappa Lambda Nu. My motivation for joining has nothing to do with becoming the first white member.
Really? Well, what is your motivation?
My mother.
Your mother?
My mother was crowned at Howard in 1943. Mary Battle, Gamma Chapter.
Your mother joined our sorority in 1943. I didn't think that...
Kathy's mother is a Negro.
Her stepmother.
My adoptive mother.
Is there a reason you never mentioned it before?
That my mother is a Negro?
No, why didn't you tell us your mother was a daughter?
Well, at first
I suggested she not say anything about her mom being a sister, unless it was really necessary. Kathy asked for my advice, and as a sponsor, I thought it would place her in a stronger position if she could show that she was able to earn her place without family playing a role.
So your Negro mother encouraged you to pledge being a daughter herself, right?
Not at all, Big Sister. Mom never encouraged me to join any sorority. She thinks the only organization I would be interested in joining is the Air Force. I haven't even told her that I'm a candy.
So you say... You could.
Let's get back to our required questions. Rhonda?
Okay. What do you think we should do to assist a Candy who's struggling academically?
Little sisters are required to maintain at least a B average during our pledge period. If our grades were to drop while pledging, it would be best that the chapter temporarily remove her from our line. She could then concentrate on her studies and improve her grades, then join the next line. Kappa Lambda Nu stresses that education comes first. It is expected that all daughters will not only graduate, but graduate with the grades needed for acceptance to graduate school.
Good answer. That's our philosophy.
Recite the Candy's code for us.
A Candy must adhere to the code of conduct without exception. She must never lie, cheat, or steal. She must perform faithfully all duties assigned to her to the best of her ability. She must comply with curfew. She...
Have you ever violated any of the code?
That's not one.
No, but let her answer.
Please answer my question, Candy.
Yes, big sister.
Which specific code have you broken?
Curfew, big sister.
Come on, explain when and why.
Last Tuesday, I didn't return to my dorm room until a little after one.
Did you ask one of your big sisters for an exemption?
No, big sister.
Did you know about this?
Of course not.
Sorry, Rhonda. I know you would have been the first to bring this issue up.
Why don't you tell us what caused you to violate curfew? Take such a risk so close to the end of your pledge period.
Someone needed me, and they pleaded with me to keep it confidential. I gave my word that I would.
You are willing to risk your dreams of becoming a daughter over a promise to this someone?
I realize what this could mean, but please hear me out.
No. We ask the questions. You just admitted breaking curfew. You did not request an exemption. You did not inform your sponsor, and you have refused to tell us why, other than a vague promise to this unidentified person.
Daughter Clara is right in this instance. This is a serious matter. We will have to review your candidacy. As of now, you are officially suspended. You are not to share what was discussed here or participate in any Candy activities until you are formally notified of our decision. Understood?
Yes, big sister.
Quickly leaves the room. Clara stands and walks towards the door.
Well, that's that.
Oh, shut up, Clara.
What's the matter with you? Period coming on.
Clara was acting. Maybe Brenda should ask you the question she asked me.
What are you getting at, Rhonda?
Well, Clara was acting like she already knew what Kathy had done.
Is that true, Clara?
So now I'm the Candy, huh? Well, just because your Candy deceived you doesn't mean you have to turn on me, Rhonda.
I noticed you didn't answer Brenda's question.
Bitch! What's gotten into you two? You're supposed to be the best of the daughters, and here you are acting like some ghetto high school girls. You need to cut it out. Now. Got it?
I don't know what got into me. Must be a combination of midterms and the impact of losing to Western in last week's meet. Sorry, Rhonda. Yeah, let's meet later.
Okay. Let's get together at 3. Wait a minute. Daughters never leave each other like this. You know what to do.
Rhonda and Clara reluctantly approach one another, hesitate, then grasp each other's hand, then touch their foreheads briefly.
That's better. See you at 3. Same instructions. Don't say anything to anyone until you hear from me.
All 3 leave. Stage darkens. End of scene 9.
All right. We're going to do some switching around here. Joy, George, go ahead and take Antoine's seat. Hotter than in Louisiana.
Oh, hotter than a jalapeno's inside.
Ooh.
I love the little ring. Ah. Already memories.
Hey, everybody seated?
All right. Everybody close to a mic? All right.
Let's have an opinion from the author.
We got George C. Corbin in the house with us at the studio tonight.
The oldest in the house. Doesn't mean I'm wise.
He's the hippest in the house, y'all.
That makes me feel good. I wrote this play partly triggered by my experience during that same year, 1963. Whole hell of a lot was going on if you know your history, and especially your black history. The bombings, Dr. King's speech, our president being assassinated at the end of the year, sit-ins, the Beatles came to the U.S. And so this idea of a sorority, I'm a frat boy, Alpha Phi Alpha.
Of course.
Phi. Yeah. Anyway, the idea of being insulated, this fortress of black men and women in a sea of white college students, proved to be of interest because it was a means of support and survival and reinforcement. My view, I almost felt like the black students at my university anyway, the fraternities, so forth, we were like foreign students, you know, regarded in the same manner. You're there, but you're not there unless you make a mark. And many of the black men and women did in terms of campus activities. But during my 4 years at Penn State, the last year we did have a white student apply and become a pledge. So that was part of the triggering. But this whole issue of finding yourself, trying to be wise when you haven't had the life experience, the trigger of race and color being dealt with, and I don't know if you remember being 19 or 18, you can think some pretty screwy things. You're trying to figure things out.
Mm-hmm. And why did you make it a sorority, though?
He's a GDI, an independent.
Let me tell you my bias. The reason I did, I thought it would be more interesting because of the emotions that are required to be talked about and the issues. Let's face it, guys are less inclined to go there. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to have a play, you got to tap into raw emotions, all of those elements. And I thought women are a lot more interesting than college frat boys.
Yes, they really are.
So let's get a word in from some of our actresses that I'm so excited about. I want to bring in Pauline because she played Kathy, our Jewish pledge in scene 9. Very talented actress from what I understand from Kurt Maxey, who spotted her in a play and then hooked her up with our wonderful director, John Freeland. So Kathy, or Pauline, see, I'm getting it all mixed up. What are your thoughts about the story and your character and what drew you into wanting to portray her?
Well, I am Jewish. So there you go.
Yay! Even more so.
I mean, the whole thing with her growing up in this black culture is really appealing to me. I'm from Philadelphia, so I've studied a lot of history, and so all that stuff really interests me. And I just was interested in hearing more about what goes on in sorority because I'm not very familiar with it.
All right.
So that was very new for me. And
so what'd you learn about it just being a pledge for make-believe in a script with big sisters and one bullying you? What'd you learn?
It's really catty. I would never want to be in one. That's
well,
for
you,
sure.
You know, I can say, given that I'm a member and I know one of the cast people here, every organization has its good and it's not so good. Mm-hmm. Just like we as human beings, we got our good side and our not so good side. So with this wonderful piece that I think George has written that I'm very excited about is, you know, this is showing the not so good side. But you also see some good sides throughout the whole script. And even though two scenes were read tonight, just to give people a taste of it, you know, it can be both ways. Mm-hmm. It can be both ways. Mm-hmm. Let's hear from your pledge sister, your line sister for Make Believe, Miss Paris Rumsford here.
Hello.
Go ahead, Paris. You got it.
Well, repeat the question.
You know, go ahead, Paris, and share with us your thoughts of the piece that you read for scene. I think it was scene 8, the first scene. Mm-hmm. You were opposite.
How did you feel
being in that situation?
Called to rat.
Yeah, to rat on one of your lines. Yeah.
It's tough. I know that people will do all kinds of things to be able to join the sorority or fraternity. I know that it's such a huge tradition in the South, especially, that people feel like they have to do it. So they will do anything that they have to do. And that's real dedication. If you're going to go against your morals to do something just to join, I think that shows a lot, and it shows commitment and dedication.
Patricia, how did you feel?
Oh, well, in England, we really don't have sororities, so this is all really new for me.
You don't?
No, we don't. So when I came to America, I'm from England, by the way.
You just have a royalty.
Right, we just have royalty. I just happen to be a part of it. No, I'm only joking. No, so this is really new for me, and like reading the script, I love the script, really learn a lot. I really identified with Rhonda because she was so compassionate to Kathy. And so I liked that role with her. Even though she was dedicated to the sorority, she still had that love and that, you know, that she's trying to keep the peace, in other words. And she really kind of like takes Kathy under her wings. And without giving too much of the end, you know, It's an amazing script.
There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. And I just loved my role.
Going in the script.
Yeah, in the script. It's amazing.
You like all of the ladies, was one of my diamond finds.
Oh, thank you.
I was very excited, and that accent's wonderful. You made us change our mind about who your character was going to be because of that great accent.
Mm-hmm, so thank you.
It worked great. You're the VP of the sorority.
Your character was.
So you were high up.
Right.
All right. Now off to Harisi, the president of the sorority for Make Believe, but a real sorority member of the esteemed sorority Delta Sigma Theta, which my mother's a proud member of, and I'm the rival, a.k.a., and we both pledged opposite of our mothers. But, you know, I've known you for a while, and we met in acting class.
Yeah.
And I know you've been in Idlewild, and you did the Freedom Writers, and you're just wonderful. So tell us how you felt about, you know, being attracted to this role, the writer's words, your character. What are your thoughts? What do you think?
Thank you. One of the things that I love so much is actually, which I feel like sometimes as an actor you don't get a chance to do often, is to be able to know about a particular subject in your personal life and then be able to act it out in a piece of art. And so to read about sorority life in George's piece was wonderful because I'm like, oh, I know this girl. I know this girl. And I'm like, oh, I know this girl. So it's wonderful because to Brenda as the chapter president, I know all too well as the president of my own line, how you kind of have to walk that fine line of being authoritative, but also still being diplomatic. And I find that Brenda struggled with that this whole piece, trying to reel Claire in, but also not trying to ostracize her, trying to make sure the pledges knew their position within the pledge process, but not trying to beat them down too harshly. And in that, she faced a lot of opposition from Clara. So that's always a hard thing when the people that are supposed to support you most don't. And so the dichotomy of dealing with that is always interesting. And also just realizing that the ideals of a sorority are always amazing. They're always wonderful. They're always progressive and positive. But people are not. They're not perfect. None of us are perfect. And so that's just, I love that overall I guess, I don't know, motif that I saw going through here. There, everyone has all these great ideas of how we should deal with each other, and but they're just never, I don't know, I guess, they never come to fruition like you imagine them to be, because we're flawed human beings.
Absolutely.
Last but not least, the track star.
Yetide, who's awesome, who's been on Masters of Sex and Aquarian and all type of stuff. Go on and tell us what you think about mean Claire. Yeah. Oh, she wasn't a nice person.
Claire's not mean. She's just misunderstood.
Oh. I love it.
Excellent. But I do think it, in reality, that's it. She was just really struggling with finding her place in the world. And what's very interesting is this pledge coming in is trying to do the same thing, but I think it's almost when you see something in someone else that you recognize in yourself, and you almost kind of, and there are many other elements in there throughout
the boyfriend.
Why she got to be with my man?
Who's not interested in you, but it's actually her boyfriend.
Right, but he's my man.
Which happens all too many times with women in sororities,
Right. So there are just so many layers, and that was one of the things that I really enjoyed in reading the script. And I think that's what really resonated with me about Clara, that she was just really trying to find herself.
Awesome. Well, you know, ladies, we'll be soon wrapping it up, but I want to say thank you to each and every one of you. I think you're all awesome and talented. And George, Kurt, and I are very excited about your play. And, you know, if we have your blessing, we'd like to try to get it up, stage reading, give these ladies first dibs.
And thank you, ladies, for
coming down so much in this hot, intemperate
weather.
And John Freeland, our awesome director. Yay! Give it up for John. John put this together. I mean, we threw this brother a lot. You know, he had to do a short story, and then this is like five people in the cast. Yeah. You know, and me and Kurt. So we put a lot on him this time, but he was awesome. We love you, John.
Yay.
Good night, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to Words and Things. Kurt, we out, bruh?
Yeah, we out. So go home and turn that air conditioner on.
Yeah, open the door. It's hotter than the jalapenos inside.